General Thorn, Reel 8.
Did you know in advance that you were going to be taken off to become an ADC?
No, it happened like this. I sensed that I was going to be shifted from St. Clair's. I'd done my 2 years, and I applied to go to the Parish of Britain. My application was withheld by the commanding officer because he needed somebody to be ADC to General Dick Goodwin. So I suddenly found, instead of going to the Parish of Britain, which I very much wanted to do, I ended up as ADC to one of the finest of regimental officers, General Dick Goodwin, who was a Suffolk officer, up in North Midland District and 49 Pellabad Division GA. Now, this was an enormous change from having been probably one of the more, certainly one of the most committed, of a very committed bunch of officers, junior officers in one or more of them. But I learned a lot from it. And I learned that ADCs are the eyes and ears of our divisional commander, and it's their duty to make sure that the general has no problems on his back so that he can then work forward with senior officers. And that also you keep a close ear on the ground about what's actually happening so you can interpret constantly and you're in close touch with people like the Colonel AQ and the Colonel GS, who will father you, but actually you need to listen to them very carefully because out of that comes the plans that are evolving and which you need to think about intelligently, as a backup to the general. So it was a good education for me. And at the same time, I played cricket for the Army and the Command Services. Was allowed to go and play sport non-stop, played squash for Nottinghamshire. On it went. Let's see. And I got, I became first reserve for the Army of Squash. So it was very good socially. Good education in speaking the language of the staff. I found myself becoming altogether too smooth for my own liking. Which you can do, and you know you're just switching it on, and you can do it so naturally, and you can be charming to people, which is lovely to be. But on the other hand, you know that if you practice it too much, you almost lose that sort of hard-edged sincerity, which is the heart of, I think, a good soldier.
Well, surely the demands are different, aren't they? At platoon level, you've got to have the straightforwardness and sincerity because you're dealing with the ordinary soldiers. But at the upper levels, you're effectively becoming a courtier.
You are. Thank you. That's a good expression. And I found it came so easily after a while. And yet, I was working in the main. I was the youngest officer in the mess. I was the youngest officer in the headquarters. I was seen as the boy. What's the boy doing, My office, ADC's office, was known as the sports shop adjunct to the general's office.
Where was the headquarters?
It was in Bestwood Lodge in Nottingham. Mm. And so I lived in the mess there. And I remember looking up to the deputy commander, a chap called Brigadier Hanmer. He sort of looked up to him a lot, and General Dick Goodwin, but also General Brigadier Hanmer. I had one or two very fine officers in the DLI, and he was a DLI officer and so on, who got military crosses in Korea and so on. And he found ways of bringing them along and holding them up as examples of fine officers at that time. And yet I noticed that, and they were fine officers, by the way, very fine. Bravery and integrity and strength of character can only replace to a certain extent the capacity of intelligence and the ability to assimilate factors and to make plans and to respond intelligently under pressure. And quite a lot of these officers that they brought forward had not got that quality of intelligence, and so they came to a halt at sort of company commander level. but were bloody good in their time. But suddenly, they had lost the bride of Eve of life in the upper echelons of the army because they couldn't cope with it.
You might say that up to a certain level in the army, what you need, beside, well, sincerity is part of this, is good instinctive leadership qualities.
Mm-hmm.
But, and that is essentially an emotional and instinctive.
Yeah.
Above a certain level, then it becomes more a matter of command than leadership, and there has to be the intellectual capacity as well.
And when I was shortly after I finished being ADC, I wrecked my back very badly playing sport.
Which sport?
Playing cricket.
Cricket.
I'd started the problem when I was playing squash.
Oh.
And I had basically wrecked my back then, unknowingly, and stretched things. Mm. And then when I was playing cricket for the Army against the Navy, I slipped a disc. And then I played with the slipped disc at Lords against the RAF, and in the end was really ill for about, what's it, P8, which is the next thing that did. Sort of physical, quality 8, physical 9 is
finished.
You've got a 6 foot by 2 foot hoe, wooden hoe, and you pipe something like that. Mm. And that was, that was an interesting dance in itself, going through the system and actually gradually getting fit, going to Hendrick Court. All that took me several months and got me into being at the depot while I recovered. And they said, yes, you can stay in the army. I trained recruits. And that was the first time that I started to think absolutely independently for myself about how to train creatively.
Yes, you were saying earlier on that one of the reasons why the army had lost its professional spirit in Germany was it had been doing the same training over and over again.
Thank
and
you.
They got bored with it.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that stuck with me.
Mm.
And so I was given this task to do with the platoon commander. You had to go through a well-set training program.
Mm.
A lot of it very basic. But there were periods when you took them out and you actually conducted your section of platoon training and elements of individual training where, if you wanted to, you could inject the realism factor in a way that enthused everybody, exercised one's own mind, and gave one a sense of deep satisfaction afterwards. And the corporals and the sergeants and the sergeant major all saw this going on and learnt themselves from it and added their thoughts. And I made friends there among the corporals, who then became some of them my sergeant majors later on, because I added value for them, and therefore then started to add value back.
And what can you do to make? I mean, obviously, if you're training recruits and you've got them coming in, you've got to give them certain basic central skills. And the essence of teaching is it has to be repetitive.
Yes.
Yeah. What can you do to make it more interesting?
Well, the first thing is you set the scene in a realistic way in terms of the enemy. Always have an enemy. Mm. Always have a good scenario. Place your training in a country, almost the countryside that fits that scenario, and then get just a few carefully organised enemy from intelligent NCOs to sharpen up the whole thing at times that are suitable and under your control, so that in a sense the lessons are being learnt and the mind is sharpened. It gets a vivid image of what has been learnt because the enemy is about, and you know, the flag goes up or something happens, and suddenly they understand why they've got to do this particular thing, why they've got to challenge in a particular way, why they've got to control the person observed so that he cannot actually damage them if he happens to be the enemy. And so these sort of lessons about a trench and the fact that you dig the sides so they don't fall in, you dig them to a certain depth because otherwise you haven't got proper protection, you hide your spoil, you act in a disciplined fashion, you don't exhaust yourself ever, and you never leave your weapon more than sort of a foot away from you, and preferably strapped to you, and these sort of basic lessons are really instilled well if you've got a good scenario and imaginative training applied. And then there has to be hard elements when you actually make them march until, you know, they're close to dropping. But you know your limits, you know their limits, and you march it very carefully. And they come back with an enormous sense of achievement.
So it's a question then of using imagination more than anything else to...
It's the added value of imagination over the top of well-established training drills. And the combination of the two then makes Tommy Atkins a happy man, frankly.
And was this sort of training going on in 49 Division when you were observing them?
Well, when I was an ADC, I used to go with the general to observe training. It was a territorial division. And so... Good basic training. Remember, one of the problems with the Total Army is they have an enormous turnover.
Yes.
And they hadn't thought through it. When I come to my time as director of infantry, I can tell you what I did for the infantry, which I think was fundamental. But I don't think everybody in the army understood at that time. I think they did really rapidly by the time it was finished. But that was basically the Total Army. And particularly its infantry was the heart of the Total Army at that time. It's because of that... The nature of that equipment and the nature of the time they have to learn to use sophisticated equipment, which is both limited, they have to be in a situation where they can fight in and from both of theirs. And that needs to be the key function of the territorial infantry, to be highly efficient and tenacious in fighting in both of theirs. And for that you need proper training systems, and you need the training areas, and you need the training villages, which we did not have. So I would say that the Territorial Army in 1957-58 is genuinely, as far as the infantry is concerned, preparing for war at a considerable disadvantage, not properly, trying properly well.
What were they good at? Were they good at basic soldiery skills?
They were a lot of intelligent people, and some of them very, very fit indeed. They were actually pretty good at almost everything, as long as they'd been given the right equipment. They could have expanded outwards, so to speak. It would have always been a limiting factor of how many of them were actually trained. But there were some very able individual soldiers and very able able units. What they're good at, quite often they were good shots. They were... They were versatile because they come from civilian life, they were doing many different jobs, they had a capacity to do things. Like eight to four power, they would be an excellent athlete because they'd got all the talents there.
Were they being trained for that sort of role? No. Presumably that would have introduced some political delicacy if they'd been trained for...
Absolutely. Yes. And yet what a common sense thing to do.
Yes. But there would be memories of the Peterloo Massacre, wouldn't there?
And, absolutely. People would have been whacking away about that. Which, in a sense, it's making too much of a lesson from long ago.
Yes, indeed. It does take a long time to adjust mentalities to new reality. But roughly what proportion of them were trained, then, would you say, when you were observing at that time?
I think it depends on ratio. As now. And I'll put it like this. That your officers and senior NCOs need to be trained because they've been there probably between 3 and 10 years. And they've got the drills right. Your corporals, some of them who've been there 3 years or more, are reasonably good. Your private soldiers, if they've been there less than a year, they were basically recruits. And the majority, I would think about between 30% and 40% would be in that category. And that's their weakness.
And that would really be a sufficient proportion to be crippling, wouldn't it, to performance, if you deployed them out as a
whole? I see, as soon as they were put under pressure. Yes. Gradually, the total entity became more efficient, retention was improved, and so forth. So by the time of the 1980s, they haven't performed very well.
Yeah. If you're thinking in terms of combat performance, in every fighting unit there are always inexperienced soldiers when it goes into battle, aren't there? It's a matter of necessity, and especially after the first encounters you get battle casualty replacements
but
turning up.
Yeah, the Tentall infantry, they come in and they'd be doing drill nights. In the first year they do X number of drill nights and a camp. In no way were they fit for anything other than a short burst of 5 or 6 days of horror, they'd have been finished. Or they'd have survived, but the potential that they would survive probably would have been enough. In terms of being soldiers who would continue to develop, I think within 15-20% of those were basically increased.
Now, you mentioned that General Goodwin was also running North Midland District. So he's wearing two hats, essentially.
Yeah.
Yes. What was the business of the district?
Well, it was an administrative organisation that made sure that your pay offices, your quite a lot of your ordnance, places like Chilwell and so on and so forth, they came under the district. They weren't in the division because they weren't going to move in the event of war. So anything that wasn't going to move in the event of war was static, became under the hat of General Goodwin as the district commander.
Did General Goodwin have a normal routine working day? Did he live life to a pattern?
Very traditional. Loved his riding, ride out early in the morning. A lovely father figure. Very sensibly professional. Intelligent, obviously. So he would get in the office about 9 o'clock. I'd be in there at 8:30. Or I'd go in with him. I'd go and collect him. And quite often that's what I did. Came and collected him. Told him what he was doing in the day. He knew anyway, but it was ABC's duty to prove that he'd actually read the diary and thought about it and got it all planned. His driver was Corporal Shakespeare. Corporal Shakespeare was a true blue cockney whose remarks would usually be in the vernacular, and so slapping on the ankles was pulling on the brakes, and you've got this sort of conversation going on most of the time. So it was quite an entertaining little setup, and the general would spend a lot of time visiting, and one of his key responsibilities is to make sure that the officers above company commander level were properly reported on the Iranian Union, and to maintain an efficient administration within which the division could be trained and the district could carry out its duties.
How were you able to train the more senior officers then in the TA division? Because the main business of the drill nights and the annual camps, that would be fine for up to, say, company level, wouldn't it? But what about above company level? Did you have a scheme of map exercises for them?
Brigade exercise and brigade compass exercises. I can't recall the division going out there, didn't. But the divisional headquarters, it may have done, but I wasn't sort of very conscious of it. Certainly, the brigades did. Brigadier Bun Cully, who was Welsh Regiment, a great sort of Welsh rugby player, he ran plainly what was a very good, forthright, practical brigade quarters.
Did the general have a lot of social commitments as well
Endless. All the time. And the ADC would go trotting along and practice his smooth chat and enjoy meeting the young as well as the old. There's some very, very good company there, and they were very kind to me. Very kind, very generous. The Civil Society there, Nottinghamshire Society.
I was going to ask about relations between the army and the civil society in Nottingham.
Very good. Emanating from the general and from his equivalents. They all got on with him, he got on with them. And I can't recall any great incident. Rather the opposite, lots of good sort of beating retreats and getting the mayor of Nottingham to come and have lunch with the general and at a guest house and all that sort of stuff. So all those conventional ways of staying close between the military and civil society, that was taking place in its 1950s context, very actively.
How long was it then, you know, how long were you doing this before you had this back injury?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half, and then you...
Then I was due to go anyway.
Yes.
And, you know, I went into hospital. And it was a pretty depressing, desperate time, but in the end I could have fought my way out of it. And that took from August of 1959 to... January of 1960, I was in plaster much of the time, and then eventually went to Headley Court in January. And by March, I was out into the depot, and I did one course, March, April, May, June, of training, and then I was picked up to be adjutant of the 4th Battalion.
What did they do with you at Headley Court?
What did they do with Headley Court? They tried to ease the severe sort of nerve pain that came on. They tried to walk.
Was this due to a trapped nerve in the spinal column?
Absolutely. And so I've had that problem ever since on and off. But once you've had it once, you learn how to control it. And you stop immediately. There's a problem. And start to sort of give us a charge of your back for cover.
I mean, is it basically a matter of exercises too?
Yeah, it's basically a matter of making sure that when you pick anything up, you pick it up in the right way. And then it's make sure your back's strong.
Yeah.
So that if you pick it up quicker, then your muscles actually protect your back.
And who were the people who were handling you at Headley Court? Were they remedial gymnasts? Were they osteopaths or all of that?
The Royal Air Force one.
Yes.
It was a really very inspiring place because a lot of people were very, very badly injured and badly hurt. And one saw extraordinary examples of courage. It was very inspiring. It didn't actually prepare me, and what prepared me was going to an American osteopath with the permission of the RAMC, because osteopaths were then PNG, persona non grata, basically.
Well, I've got the impression that people like osteopaths, chiropractors, physiotherapists were accepted by the army as such a lot earlier than they were accepted by the medical profession as such.
I think that's very fair. Mm. I was allowed to go and see this guy who was president of the Osteopath Association. He was an American, but he was president of the Osteopath. Very, very careful man. I was x-rayed head to foot, and then it hadn't been done by anyone else, head to foot. And then he said, this is what the problem is I'm going to do this, and it'll take some time because it's so long since you've actually been free. And in about 3 or 4 sessions, he got me right. And that probably saved my army career, frankly, because I was not able to run anything.
Where were the 4th Battalion of the Norfolks based?
Based in Norwich, but we had stations in Durham and King's Lynn and Yarmouth and Wyndham. And their headquarters up at the depot, these wooden huts just beside the depot. And I was adjunct to a TA officer, Dick Flower, who's still alive. And I had enormous interest because my predecessor, I was then a young captain, I was 26. That was acting captain. And I was adjunct. And I got a TA, so I was basically commanding officer for most of the time, but acting sensibly and new humility. So I learned again, hand over fist. And it did nearly what it could. And I then made enormous friends with so many people in Norfolk. Well, I played cricket for Norfolk and squash for Norfolk. That's my best successes in terms of army cricket then. So in terms of sport, it was marvellous. In terms of military, it was excellent because I did the staff college exam there, passed that, and then was sent from TA in 1962, got married, and that's right, and then went to staff college in September of 62.
What were the main duties of the adjutant? Were they the same as they would have been in a regular battalion, or were they more wider. Extensive, wider?
Because you've got few professional staff, therefore you actually had to take on more. But you've got a much more transient group of soldiers, because most days they weren't there. You were preparing for the next drill night, or the next town weekend or the regimental weekend, and getting all the staff work done. You know, you were kept up to the mark in terms of your own training by the brigade quarters. It was an education in running a battalion, but with good pauses so that you could get ready for the next step.
One of the main functions of an adjutant in a normal, regular battalion, of course, is discipline. Did you have that function as well with the 4th?
Oh, very battalion. Definitely. Very definitely. Yeah. But there really wasn't the sort of discipline problems that you tended to have with a regular battalion, where you're 24 hours a day, the incidence of drunkenness would be much higher, because you've got more men, etc. And the TA on the whole come out to work, you can't make them quickly sacked if they come out and really get drunk. And so, on the whole, their head is pretty good, and 48 hours of head is open, you get a little pay pain in this, shoots them down to the ground. So their discipline was, I can't remember anyone being charged, but maybe they were.
And how were they, in their sort of character, mentality, outlook, how did the TA soldiers compare to the regulars with whom you'd been used to dealing?
Okay. Well, the first thing is that they were, some of them were less disciplined. Quite a lot of them were less fit. But their versatility and their willingness was a match for anything the army could produce. Basically, in a short war, sort of a week, 10 days, that unit could have been very useful to somebody. Anything longer than that, it would have collapsed.
Would that be because they were not sufficiently hardened to accept the tax on their stamina of prolonged operations?
Yes, that's the first reason, and the second reason is, I think, if you're not properly trained, you're hurling yourself forward to be trained while also acting. You take an enormous lot out of yourself and you drain your confidence. I would say they'd have lost confidence after about 10, 11 days if the action was there.
So that would have been a matter of exhaustion then? Emotional exhaustion as well as physical exhaustion.
Too much been taken out of them.
What sort of role were they being trained for?
In the case of Royal Norfolk, home defence, and it was really strong point guarding, being having the ability to react if a problem occurred. So one or two of the companies had sort of a reactive role capability, but the key thing was protecting the all sorts of things like the electricity stations, the pumping stations. Anything like that.
Vital points
were the basis of everything we did.
What was the state of their equipment?
Well, they kept it in quite good order, but it was old. At that stage, they had another four and the regular army had this operating rifle. So the transition.